Many thanks again to Laura Jane for helping to choose the praise items for today's services. They have fitted the theme so really, really well, and I appreciate your help on that. How anybody can put themselves into the middle of a herd of animals that are way bigger than themselves, I will never know. I used to watch our neighbouring farmers in the fields around the Manson and Muckamore and think to myself, no way, Jose, you wouldn't catch me doing that. Especially whenever there are bulls about. Not me. I remember being across in the church hall one day sorting out things for the midweek that night and hearing the cattle quite loudly and thinking to myself, why does those cows sound really loud today? And as I looked out the window, I could see a herd of cows in the field at the end of the car park, and I thought, why, they are making a one racket. And then I realized it wasn't them. It was actually the herd of cows that were in the manse garden who were making the racket. And being not too comfortable around big animals, I thought, what am I going to do now? And I ran across towards the manse, and there's a back gate into the garden. Went in through that gate to try to, shush them out. And I thought, you're mad, Peter, you're mad. Anyway, out the cows went, and they eventually disappeared. The farmer came along and helped to get them out. That evening, he called round, and he rang the doorbell, jumped back into the shogun, and waited for me to come out. And he says, terrible, sorry about the cows today. I says, no problem, John. Sure, they went and off they went, and that was okay. Ah, but he says, they made a real mess of that lawn of yours. We'll get that sorted. I said, John, wait till I tell you, it could have been worse. What do you mean? I said, it could have been Rodney's cows that were in our garden. And I said, if Rodney's cows were in our garden, Rodney's bull would have been in our garden. And what makes you think that my bull wasn't in your garden? I said, was it? Yes. I know I'm a big girl's blouse, really, when it comes to that. But anyway, I'm definitely no farmer. But having said that, I do enjoy watching programs about farming on television, of course, from the comfort and safety of the sofa in front of the television. One such program was Born Mucky, Life on the Farm. A great title. I don't know who thought that, but they deserve a praise. Born Mucky, Life on the Farm. One of the farmers in it was called Ian Steele, who originally had no interest in following his father into agriculture. He said, I was determined not to go into farming, and so I did an engineering degree and went into the petrochemical industry. Now, he would have been the fourth generation of his family to run the farm, but his father's life had been a struggle, and Ian said that he wanted something different. It's funny how things can change, though, isn't it? He came back home to help when his father took ill on one occasion. And guess what? He got the bug. He was so pleased to be back in Shropshire that he said, I decided to have a complete career change. We sold the dairy herd, and as we'd always kept a few pigs, I went down that route. And the rest is history, as they say. Today, in addition to the farming side of things, Treflack Farm has a butchery and bakery business, camping and glamping, and therapeutic projects for children and young adults. Would any of that have been there without Ian? Probably not. His family may well have sold up and walked away. 1 Kings 19:19-21 takes us to a family farm where one of the sons, perhaps the only son, Elisha, was ploughing alongside 11 other yoke of oxen. Not quite the equivalent of today's combine harvesters costing, £250,000 plus, alongside the latest tractors and other machinery. But still, this was a farm that was obviously in a good way of going, as we would say. Whether Elisha had taken over the farm from his father, Shaphat, or was simply working alongside the other farm workers, I'm sure that as he got out of his bed that morning and headed into the fields for a hard day's work, he had no idea how things would be so different by the time he would go to bed that night. Now, when we left Elijah at Mount Horeb a few weeks ago in our studies together, we'd advocated that it wasn't so much a pity party at Horeb as a courtroom scene in which Elijah was counsel for the prosecution in the case of the Lord versus the people. Instead of pining away in depression and self-pity, as many others imagined to be the case, I believe Elijah had successfully brought an indictment against God's people, pressing home the charge of being in breach of the covenant that had been made on that very same mountain between the Lord and his people through Moses. A breach that saw his people worshiping other gods instead of him, the one true God. And the judge of all the earth, the Lord himself, well, he handed down his verdict, guilty as charged. How do we know that? It's implied in his response to Elijah's summing up. In due course, there would be a change of the guard in the shape of a new political and religious order in Israel, with three figures playing important roles in this change: Hazael, Jehu, and Elisha. The Lord would use Hazael to punish Israel for its failure to turn away from Baal worship and restore his covenant with them. The Lord would use Jehu to punish Ahab and Jezebel for leading Israel astray and failing to bring about the change that was needed following the clear and unequivocal display of power on Mount Carmel that declared Baal to be no god and the Lord to be the one true God. And the Lord would use Elisha as a Samuel-like figure, providing guidance and direction from the Lord to those who turned to him for help over some 40 to 50 years. And that day on Shaphat's farm was like the very first stalks of new growth pushing their way up through the soil. Just enough to give you the sense that they're there. Just enough to be a sign of things to come. The promise of a harvest. Well, Elijah set off, as the Lord had said, towards Damascus, way up in the north, hundreds of miles from Mount Horeb, and beyond Israel itself, actually, into Aram, or as we would call it, Syria. It's a journey that takes him through familiar territory, territory that we have walked through with Elijah over the past few months, close to the Wadi Kerith, where he was fed by the ravens and supplied with water until that dried up, just across the River Jordan from his hometown in Tishbe in Gilead, arriving at a town called Abel Meholah, where Shaphat's farm was situated. Imagine how surprised the 11 men working the yoke of oxen must have been when Elijah walked across the field, threw his cloak over Elisha, as he too worked his yoke of oxen alongside the other 11. And then Elijah started to walk away again. Elisha, though, and everyone with him, knew exactly what was going on here. They knew who the man was. Elijah, the man of God. And they knew what this man of God was doing, summoning Elisha as his personal assistant. Leaving his animals, Elisha ran after Elijah and said to him, "Let me kiss my father and mother goodbye, and then I'll come with you." Now, does that remind you of anything? It should, if you were here last Sunday morning, because Ian McNee looked at Luke chapter 9, the passage where Jesus said to a man, "Follow me," only for the man to reply, "I will follow you, Lord, but first let me go back and say goodbye to my family." Is this what Elisha was saying to Elijah? Well, from what Jesus says to the man in Luke chapter 9, the answer is no. This is not the same thing that Elisha was saying to Elijah as the man said to Jesus. You see, Jesus replied to the man, "No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for service in the kingdom." Now, looks back in the original is a participle. It's a present participle, which means it's a continual thing. So it's looking back continually, not just to glance back to see what was going on, but actually keeping looking back all the time. Now, can you imagine someone who puts his hand to a plow to go through a field, looking back instead of where he's going? What would the furrow look like? Well, it would zigzag all over the place if he even made it to the far end of the field. So when Elisha heard when Elijah heard what Elisha said to him, he had no hesitation in saying to Elisha, "Yes, go and do that. Go and do that." You see, the man who was talking to Jesus wasn't focused. He wasn't concentrating on the job. But Elisha clearly wasn't in two minds. He was genuinely going back to say goodbye to his family and then go with Elijah. And Elijah understood that. And we know that from what he replied to him. In fact, Elijah encouraged him to do so. "Go back," he says. "What have I done to you?" Now, we could be forgiven for reading that wrongly, as if Elijah has just realized the full impact of what he's asking of Elisha. "Oh, what have I done to you, asking you to leave your family like this and come away with me?" But that's not what's happening. There's a preposition between the "go back" and the "what" in the Hebrew that gives Elijah's comment the sense of, "By all means, go back, but remember what I've just done to you." The translation that Sandra read from earlier reflected that meaning. Go back, but remember what I've just done to you. Called you to follow me. Well, he needn't have worried, because Elisha had no intention of turning down Elijah's call to him. He goes and he tells his family that he's leaving, and as he leaves, what does he do? He has an impromptu barbecue for everyone, roasting the two oxen with which he'd been plowing on the plowing equipment that he had been using. You talk about burning your bridges, no going back after that. He was going with Elijah. That was for sure. It's a costly thing for him to do, though, wasn't it? Walking away from a successful family farm to an uncertain, perhaps even dangerous future, to become what? Elijah's attendant? His valet might be a good way of putting it, attending to Elijah's personal needs and dealing with any other tasks that Elijah required of him. A number of years later, 2 Kings chapter 3 tells us how the kings of Israel, Judah, and Edom formed a coalition against the king of Moab. But from the outset, they encountered problems. Now, the king of Israel, who happened to be Ahab's son, was exasperated. But the king of Judah asked, "Is there no prophet of the Lord here in Israel that we may inquire of the Lord through him?" An officer of the king of Israel steps forward and answers, "Elisha, son of Shaphat, is here. He used to pour water on the hands of Elijah." He used to wash Elijah's hands. What sort of position was that? It wasn't exactly the most high-powered of positions, was it? Elijah's personal valet? Is that what Elisha left the family farm for? To enter service as Elijah's servant? Yes. We might frown on the idea of household service these days, you know, feeling it to be demeaning and degrading in some respects, you know, the old upstairs, downstairs type of thing. But actually, documentaries about the royal households in Britain and dramas like Downton Abbey suggest that many of the people working in such positions have a sense of privilege in being fortunate enough to work for families like these, be it the royal family or the Crawley family, even enjoying a certain prestige that goes with the standing of the family concerned. And so it was with Elisha. As far as he was concerned, it was a privilege to serve Elijah in this way. After all, it wasn't just Elijah he would be serving, but the Lord. It might have seemed pretty mundane and unremarkable at this particular stage of his life, but the Lord was preparing Elisha for when Elijah would no longer be with him and he would succeed Elijah as the Lord's prophet in Israel. Elijah has all but had his day, the time when it was established that the Lord is God, which is what the name Elijah means. The new era of salvation belongs to Elisha, whose name means the Lord saves. Now, I suppose we might be tempted to think that the events in the field at Abel-Meholah have little or nothing to do with us. This was a unique situation in which Elisha is called to be Elijah's successor, a very special, one-of-a-kind, never-to-be-repeated role. But that would be to miss the point of the story being recorded for us in the first place. You see, it highlights a couple of important things that apply to every single Christian man, woman, and young person. What God is entitled to do, and what we are obligated to do. What God is entitled to do, and what we are obligated to do. God is entitled to command our obedience. He is the Lord, the one true God, the one who has made us in his own image, and we are obligated to obey him. We need to remember who we are as God's people, servants who are ready to do his will. Isn't that the example Jesus has set for us, who, as Paul describes in Philippians 2, being in very nature God, not just made in the image of God, but being God. He set aside the privileges of deity and took on the status of a servant and died a selfless, obedient death. That's how we should see ourselves. Servants, obedient to the day we die. What a privilege it is to serve the living God. He's the best master anyone could ever have. Oh, it might not be the most glamorous of lives to live compared to others who simply live to please themselves. But what else matters? Really, what else matters? So long as God's plans and purposes are being worked out in us and through us. It's the only life worth living at the end of the day. For it's the only life that will save us from the judgment to come when Jesus returns to wrap up this broken, sinful, dying world and establish the new world in which God's faithful, obedient people will live forever. Many people think it's too costly to allow God to have his rightful place in their life. The truth is, it's too costly not to. Give him his place. He's entitled to command your obedience, and we're obligated to give it. Let's pray together.